It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
It's the Media Buzz Meter with Howard Kurtz.
Some loyal listener posted something saying, why don't I stop talking about Caitlin Clark? You're sick of hearing about Caitlin Clark. What's my obsession with Caitlin Clark? Well, I probably was a little obsessed during the NCAA playoffs when this incredible shooter, you know, led her Iowa team to the championship game only to lose. But also, that final game outdrawing the men's final by millions of viewers. I think it got up to 19 million. So that was news. And now I'm talking about her because she keeps making news as this pop culture phenomenon going on SNL and so forth. So the latest is she's been drafted number one in the WNBA by the Indiana Fever. And there were a couple of stories saying, the imbalance in what players get, depending on whether they're the NBA or the women's league, is pretty incredible because I think she was going to be paid $76,000, whereas there was some other highly ranked guy in the NBA being paid $10 million. Well, don't worry about that because she's about to sign, according to The Athletic, part of the New York Times, a deal with Nike worth over $20 million. Under Armour and Adidas have also made offers to her. So because she is sort of widely known now, I mean, who cares what the WNBA pays her? $20 million plus potential bonuses? All right. First of all, hope you have a great weekend coming up. Second of all, with Israel retaliating against Iran, I have so much stuff now to fit into Media Buzz. And a little plug here, after months of requests, I'll be talking to former House Speaker Kevin McCarthy about the problems the Republicans are having, about Ukraine, about his own ouster nearly 7 months ago. So that'll be an interesting conversation. It'll be on set with me. But I want to just take, 30 seconds to talk about spelling. Like, I get that most people in journalism don't care about grammar anymore, and I'm kind of a stickler for it, and you may not care either. But I thought of this because there was a piece on Caitlin Clark. In other words, it was about her. It wasn't just a mention. And Caitlin was spelled wrong. You know, you don't even have to, like in the old days, you had to go to the library and get the clips and make sure you were spelling it right. You don't even have to, you can start to Google it and you type in, I don't know, the first three letters and it's autocomplete and that gives it to you. Well, on Mediaite, there was an item about Jesse Waters and people want to praise or rip Jesse Waters, that's fine. And he spells his name with an S on the end, Jesse Waters. But when they got to the possessive, what Waters had done, it was water, apostrophe S. And I just like held my head in my hands. You know, if I was hiring somebody just to be a clerk at a shipping company, I would want to know that they could get the address right. And then it just stays up there and nobody corrects it. Anyway, I'm very sad to report, and some of you younger listeners may not know the name, Dickie Betts, a co-founder of the Allman Brothers, has died at the age of 80. This guy, one of the best lead guitarists in the universe, and I saw the Allman Brothers at Madison Square Garden once, and there's just something about the way Dickie Betts plays. It is his leads are forceful and powerful and distinctive. You know, if you blindfolded me and just put on even a song I didn't know, I would say, oh yeah, that must be Dickie Betts. And he also was a really good writer. He wrote Ramblin' Man, which was a huge hit for the Allman Brothers. And he wrote a couple other songs, including Blue Sky and Southbound. And the Allman Brothers were unique when they came on the scene in 1969 because they didn't just do three-minute pop songs. I mean, on their albums, and particularly their live album, which is called at Fillmore East, live at Fillmore East, you know, the jamming would just go on for many, many minutes. Now, the Allman Brothers were also unlucky because within a year, Dwayne Allman, one of the founders, died in a motorcycle accident. This is in the early 70s. And Berry Oakley was killed in a motorcycle crash a year later. So that left Dickie Betts and Greg Allman as the leaders, and they would play off each other with dueling guitar leads in a way that was amazing. And they also came out in 1976 for Jimmy Carter, which gave him credibility among younger rock fans. So sorry to hear about the passing of Dickie Betts, but the big news, I guess, in the music world is Taylor Swift. 2 a.m. this morning, she dropped the Tortured Poets Department. And there's a fascinating background here to the level of promotion. Not that she's already not one of the most famous people on the planet. There is a Swift-branded library installation on Spotify. Videos on her social media accounts showing antique typewriters and globes. Sirius XM now has a Swift radio station. And she didn't do any interviews with journalists because she doesn't have to. That's what you do when you need to promote something. When you're Taylor Swift, everybody comes to you. Threads, which is part of Meta, got Swifties all excited about this. And the album itself, it was 16 songs. Now it's 15, I guess, and there may be some others. She said, I've written so much tortured poetry in the last 2 years and wanted to share it all with you. And there's a reference to her boyfriend, Travis Kelce, about the Chiefs trying to be the best in the league and the trophy, and he kissed her. Look, why not? All right. Let's get more serious now with story number one. Early this morning, Eastern time, but later in the day in the Middle East, the Israeli military retaliated against Iran for the bombardment of more than 300 missiles and drones against Israel's, thankfully, was spectacularly unsuccessful. So the question was, has been for days now, what would Israel do? Would that escalate the war? Would then Iran feel the need to strike back again? So Israel felt it wanted to demonstrate that it could hit Iranian territory since the Iranians had so much trouble landing its drones and missiles because of the superior air defense systems that Israel has, as well as additional missiles shot down by the U.S., by Britain and by France, and by Jordan, by the way, when the weapons cross their airspace. So Israel hit a military base in Iran, not proxies in some other country. But the damage seemed to be very limited. This is, in fact, the place where Iran works on its nuclear program. And since Iran is no longer bound by the nuclear agreement that the Obama administration had, because the Trump administration undid it, they are getting frighteningly close to having a nuclear weapon and being able to deliver it. But according to reporting in the New York Times, Israeli leaders almost ordered widespread strikes in Iran the night that Iran attacked. But Bibi Netanyahu spoke with President Biden, and because the damage in Israel is so limited, the war cabinet postponed a decision. So what's interesting here is both Israel and Iran seem to be playing down. There hasn't even been a public declaration about this. This counterattack by Israel. The coverage has been muted in both countries. Iranian officials said the attack on the military base was carried out by small drones. A separate group of small drones was shot down about 500 miles away from this military base. Now, the president of Iran had warned that the tiniest act of aggression would draw a response, but at least as I'm speaking to you now, Iranians are not calling for any, publicly at least, for any retribution. That could change. And you could get further exchanges that could well easily lead to a wider war. But Israel, I think, under strong pressure from the U.S., decided, yes, to hit a military base. And at the same time, not to be boasting about it, and sort of hoping that this is the end of the tit-for-tat exchanges. Now, in a Washington Post piece, it says limited action appeared to many experts to be part of attempts by both sides to de-escalate the situation. In fact, the Russian foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov, said Iran, which naturally has close ties with Moscow, had reached out to defuse the situation. Everybody stressing that the nuclear labs were not touched. So it appeared to be kind of a pinprick attack. Israel's not saying much. Iran is downplaying its significance. I guess each country hopes that what it did, Iran last weekend, which in the Iranians' view was retaliation for Israel going after, well, killing three senior Iranian commanders at a consulate in Syria. But both sides now hoping the exchanges so far may be enough to satisfy domestic audiences without requiring further escalation. Meanwhile, U.S. and Britain imposing new sanctions on Iranian military leaders and weapons makers as a result of the missile and drone attack on Israel. Remember, I mean, this worked out really well. In fact, one of the contrasts here, and I think the reason that Israel decided to hit this military base, is clearly the Iranian missiles and drones, the overwhelming majority of them, 99%, did not get through. Had some gotten through it, a lot of Israelis been killed, we've been looking at a different situation right now. But nevertheless, U.S. and Britain imposing these sanctions, I mean, look, previous sanctions have not been terribly effective, let's be candid about that. But Israel showing that it can hit Iranian territory. And so that's really the message here, not so much whatever damage was done or not done, but a kind of a flashing red warning signal that Israel has that capability. President Biden saying the sanctions will further degrade Iran's military industries. The U.S. is committed to Israel's security. Britain said it imposed sanctions on seven people and six entities linked to Iran's regional military activity and its attack on Israel. The European Council announcing new sanctions on behalf of European nations. So everybody's kind of feeling the need to do something, show their home audiences that they're doing something. And yet, not go too far. Now, a very important related story is that House Republicans, this is last night, led by Speaker Mike Johnson. And I just have to stop here. This is a guy who, when he was just representing his district in Louisiana, voted against every Ukraine bill. And now he is trying to get Ukraine aid through as the speaker, even though it may cost him his job. And everyone's covering sort of the maneuvering, and I'll get to that in a second, but I mean, I think Mike Johnson deserves some praise here. This is a dramatic thing for him to do because there are a lot of Republican hardliners who oppose this. And he could lose his job over this, and he's saying, you know, bring it on. This isn't a guy who lusted to be speaker his whole life. He was a compromise choice, and I think the media ought to give him a tip of the hat. Now, can he do it on his own? No. It turns out that in taking the next legislative step and hoping that he will have a final vote on Saturday night, which means we'll be working overtime Sunday morning, he had to rely on Democratic votes.
Hey, let's pause right there. The buzz meter continues right after this.
Kudlow on Fox Business is now on the go for podcast fans. Get key interviews with the biggest business newsmakers of the day. The Kudlow podcast will be available on the go after the show every weekday at foxbusinesspodcasts.com or wherever you download your favorite podcasts.
So the Rules Committee, you can't bring a bill to the floor in the House without going through the Rules Committee. And usually the Speaker controls the Rules Committee. Well, what happened is three Republicans on the Rules Committee said, we don't like this. We're not voting to bring this to the floor. So to get it out of rules by a 9-3 vote, Mike Johnson had to rely on Democratic votes. These hardline Republicans are trying to kill it off. And the same thing may happen on the floor. Since Johnson can only afford to lose 2 or 3 votes, it's the Democrats who, with support from the White House, want to push this thing through. You know, there's a lot of back and forth about, well, you know, there's a separate bill for Israel, there's a separate bill for Ukraine. What will the Republicans get in exchange for going along to this? But more importantly, what will the Democrats get? They're not giving this away for free. They don't love Mike Johnson. But they may save his job. That gets into, you know, complicated parliamentary maneuvering. So here's what Johnson told Newsmax. I'd rather send bullets to Ukraine than American boys. We don't want to have boots on the ground, and we can prevent that by allowing them to hold Putin at bay. So he's become, you know, even with, I would say, muted opposition from Donald Trump, who killed off that compromise Senate bill, at least in the House, where there was going to be much tougher border security measures in this country. And when Trump was asked about Mike Johnson the other day outside the courthouse, he was told, oh, we'll see what happens. Not exactly putting the full weight and prestige of the ex-presidency behind the Republican speaker. That was actually at the bodega in Harlem. So story number two is the jury selection. There's now a jury. 12 jurors and one alternate have been chosen. 5 more alternates are needed. And we have, and then before that happened, there had been 7 chosen. 2 were knocked off. There was credibility about the answers of one of the people. This guy was kicked off, and he was asked by reporters, should he have been dismissed? And he said, nope. Another juror was knocked out by Judge Merchan, after being seated. There was also one who had an arrest record. Anyway, a lot of them are nervous because too much identifying information has been given out. And Judge Merchan has scolded the press, rightly in my view. As I've mentioned, you know, if you say the person is a, you know, works at a bank, and is a man or a woman, and has 3 children, and other identifying details, you're outing them. And a number of the people in the jury pool, you know, you can just raise your hand and say, I can't be fair, but some of them just expressed concern for their safety. So Mertron ordered news organizations not to report to two questions on this questionnaire that he gives to prospective jurors. Who was your current employer and who was your prior employer? I mean, once you know that, that's a major piece of the puzzle. Now, prosecutors were urging the judge to hold Trump in contempt of court, saying he kept violating the gag order. And this was interesting. Todd Blanche, the Trump lawyer, asked for the names of the first three witnesses, who will probably begin on Monday. And it's a courtesy so they can know where to, you know, do their preparation that is usually extended to either side. And the prosecutor refused to provide it, refused to give Trump's lawyer the first three witnesses because, quote, Mr. Trump has been tweeting about the witnesses. The judge responded, I can't fault them for that. And he wouldn't order them to turn over the witnesses' names. Oh, by the way, one of the potential jurors who was knocked off yesterday, you know, Trump had to sit there and listen to this and wasn't allowed to respond. Trump is an anathema to everything I was taught about love. And Merchan started questioning her about her past post, that one I just read. There's also one where she called Trump racist, sexist, and a narcissist. And the woman says, oops, that sounds bad. And he kicked her off. I don't know. The judge kicked her off. I think I would have done the same thing. A racist, a sexist, and a narcissist. But you come in and say, oh, yeah, I can be perfectly fair. Story three. In the New York Post, I've talked a lot, obviously, about the resignation under pressure of Uri Berliner at NPR, a guy who called out his own news organization for going off the rails into just blatant left-wing activism. And a lot of focus now on the new CEO, as I have mentioned. This is Catherine Marr, who had all these tweets about, first of all, she did get out the vote work for Joe Biden. She wore a Biden campaign cap, put a picture. She criticized Hillary for erasing gender-neutral language because she said boys and girls. But now the New York Post has a story saying, can someone who donated to an organization spreading falsehoods about stolen elections, we hear a lot about that lately, be the CEO of a credible news organization? And what would have happened if, the Post giving this example, if ABC's coverage was discovered that the president of ABC News had donated to Donald Trump after January 6th, there would have been a huge uproar. So, turns out that Catherine Marr, who now runs NPR, is a donor to Stacey Abrams' election-denying political action committee called Fair Fight. Abrams lost, you know, she ran twice for governor of Georgia. She lost that first one in 2018. She never conceded. She said the election had been stolen. It was unfair. She literally never did what most losing candidates do, which is to call your opponent and concede. And this piece by David Mastio, as he first reported in the Center Square, he says Abrams concocted false allegations about voting machines switching votes. That rings a vague bell. That Abrams' PAC filed a lawsuit contesting the election. The lawsuit was eventually dismissed, and this Stacey Abrams group, Fair Fight, was forced to pay the state's legal fees. The Post says that the double standard here is shocking. The New York tabloid said, look, Trump's lawyers, their credibility was shattered, and some of them have pleaded guilty, when they made allegations about election machines and lost those cases in court. But Abrams makes these same false allegations, and at the time she was pretty prominent as the CEO of the Wikimedia Foundation, not Wikipedia.
Hey, let's pause right there. The buzz meter continues right after this.
All right, number four. speaking of Donald J. Trump, Nate Cohn, in his newsletter for the New York Times, says, Donald Trump appears to be a stronger candidate than he was 4 years ago, according to polling. And not just because a lot of voters look back on his presidency as a time of relative peace and prosperity. It's also because his political liabilities don't dominate the news the way they once did. I'm going to give you this argument, and then I'm going to tell you why it's wrong. In the last New York Times Siena College poll, only 38% of voters said they'd been offended by Trump recently, even as more than 70% said they'd been offended by him at some point. If there had been further questioning in the poll, more voters would have said yes to the recently offended question, perhaps. Trump's almost outrageous comments just don't dominate the news cycle the way they did 4 to 8 years ago. Many voters seem to be turning out his legal challenges, tuning out, I should say. A majority of voters said they thought he committed federal crimes, but only 27% of registered voters in that poll said they were paying a lot of attention to the news about the legal cases against him, much lower than the 39% who said they were back in 2019. That was the first Trump impeachment involving Ukraine and the perfect phone call. So Nate Cohn concludes voters still don't like him generally, but his liabilities aren't in the forefront of people's minds, making it easier for the haters to back him over President Biden. Now, look, I don't know. Do people who write these pieces, do they own a television set? I mean, there is this question of, does the media normalize what Trump says? So, you know, and I talked to the former president about this when we had our interview at Mar-a-Lago, which, by the way, he was quite pleased with. And he said, you know, he uses words referring to illegal migrants who commit crimes, such as vermin and animals, because that gets media attention and drives the coverage. I don't know, you turn on a TV this week, even Wednesday, which was an off day at the trial, there was just constant talk and blather about Trump. So it may well be true that people have just gotten inured to it, but the idea that it just doesn't get as much attention is just absolutely untrue. And it's not just cable news. You look at the live updates in papers like the Washington Post and the New York Times, they're constantly covering every bit of minutia about jury selection and gag order and everything that's going on in that courthouse. In fact, a couple of the jurors who've been knocked off, potential jurors, I should say, you know, they'd come out and do interviews, particularly with MSNBC, and they just would say things like, this one woman, he didn't look that orange. He looked more yellow to me, and he's not my cup of tea. And it's just no particular insight, just like how surreal the experience is. And by the way, at the end of yesterday's proceeding, Donald Trump came out and talked to reporters. He had a thick stack of clips, and he started reading from them about he says all legal experts think this is a terrible case and never should have been brought and a dumb indictment. Well, most of what he rattled off was from places like Wall Street Journal editorial page. There was mention of at least three Fox News commentators, Jonathan Turley, Andy McCarthy, for example. And others you could just tell were pieces by conservatives, maybe not all. MSNBC, which has, you know, its former prosecutors and legal beagles and just, you know, liberal guests come on and trash Trump all day long. Nicole Wallace comes out and says, as Trump starts to speak, well, we're not going to show you this. We're not going to show him live. We're not going to give him 5 minutes to talk after we've trashed him for days, weeks, months. We just don't do that. If he says anything that we think is newsworthy, then we'll come back later and share it with you. we are the deciders of what you should see. I mean, Trump only spoke for about 5 minutes, and he's mostly reading from headlines. Anyway, let's wrap up with story number five. I've been meaning to get to this a couple of days. So in the Atlantic, David Frum, former George W. Bush speechwriter and now anti-Trump conservative, says on this question of whether the two men should debate, which the networks all came out for, Joe Biden, Donald Trump. Biden's spokesman should say this: the Constitution is not debatable. The president does not participate in forums with a person under criminal indictment for his attempt to overthrow the Constitution. Frum goes on to say the single most important question on the ballot for 2024, does any of this matter? Is violence by losers to overturn election results an acceptable tool of politics? Is anti-constitutional violence by election losers just another political issue like inflation or immigration or foreign policy? And look, I understand the argument, but here's the reality. If it gets to be September and Joe Biden is 6 points behind, he'll debate. If the primary race had been close on the GOP side, close at all, Donald Trump would have debated. You don't debate when you think you can get away with it. If you need debates because you're losing and you want to change the narrative, then you go out there and do it. But he didn't address any of that. He just talked about that, you know, Trump is such a low character, supported violence, under indictment, that Joe should just blow him off. Well, we shall see what that happens. If I had to guess, if I had to bet, I don't bet on these things, but I would say there are not going to be any debates. I don't know that it's in Biden's interest to debate Trump. There'll be a contrast in their energy level. And remember, the first debate in 2020, Trump talked over him constantly, as well as the moderator, and then pulled out of the second debate. And that was the COVID year, so it may have been a little more complicated. Anyway, once again, check out Media Buzz, Fox News Channel, 11 a.m. Eastern, Sunday morning. Still a work in progress. Have yourself a great weekend. Hope you will. Please come back Monday when I will be here with more BuzzMeter. Listen ad-free on Fox News Podcasts and via Apple Podcasts, and Prime members can listen to this show ad-free on Amazon Music.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network, subscribe and listen to the Trey Gowdy Podcast. Former federal prosecutor and four-term U.S. congressman from South Carolina brings you a one-of-a-kind podcast. Subscribe and listen now by going to foxnewspodcasts.com.